Now, as I understand, you've been the CEO and president of PBS for 10 years now.
Yes.
I wonder how public media has changed in your time at PBS.
Well, you know, the last 10 years has been just a swirl in terms of the change in media itself. When I came to PBS 10 years ago, iTunes announced that they were going to sell episodes of Desperate Housewives for $1.99, and it sounded so strange. And of course, now we live in an environment where it's the expectation that you can access anything you want when you want it. And so the technology has really, I think, driven a whole different understanding of how media organizations relate to their viewers.
And I feel like, especially with brands like PBS, like NPR, there is the expectation that they exist and rely solely on their terrestrial media. And brands like iTunes, you said, that was selling Desperate Housewives, they exist from the beginning on the internet. I wonder if you feel like you need to pivot or change your brand at all to accommodate that.
No, in fact, I think brands matter more now in this environment than ever, because in part the consumer, the viewer, is overwhelmed with an avalanche of viewing experiences. And I think when you look at powerful brands like NPR and PBS that have been established over decades and really represent quality and a certain type of content, it really is a helpful element in helping people make content decisions. Look, we're awash now in media options. Our audiences actually on broadcast television have grown. And so if you look just from a Nielsen basis, our audiences have gone up over the last few years, not gone down. And I think in part because of our focus on the integrity of the content. So you've asked me what changed, but what also stays the same? And I think that relentless commitment to content that we hope is entertaining, but that also is educational and inspirational, is that through line that I think draws people. But I also think this new technology and the ability for people to watch on a demand basis, but then also come into a broadcast basis.
Now, there's the perception in public media in general that it, as a whole, the people who work in it and the people who watch it, it's getting older and whiter. And I wonder what you're doing to combat that perception.
So our organization is probably more diverse, both in terms of the people working at PBS as well as the audience that we're pursuing, than I think in any time in our history. If you pull apart public television, because we are a little different than NPR in this regard, we are a variety service. So we spend 8 hours a day focused on viewers under the age of 8. And that has always been a hugely diverse audience. In fact, we over-index in homes without cable and homes without computer. We over-index in homes where English may not be a first language. And I think that as we've looked at the programs themselves, we've always tried to make sure that the programs are reflecting a range of viewer experiences and backgrounds. I think in prime time and in the work that we're doing, yes, television itself, broadcast television tends to be older, but I think we've seen that through the ways that we've thought about the programming that we're bringing forward, there is a growing appetite for independent film. We're the largest home of independent film on television. And so I think that this is a space where we're bringing in a more diverse audience, but frankly, that's, again, coming back to the whole question of digital platforms. Within PBS, our digital team is younger, it is more diverse, and the stories that we're producing reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned grabbing kids when they're young. I watched PBS when I was little. I know lots of people did, but I still feel like maybe there's that gap where after that period, maybe you lose them. What's your strategy to getting them to latch back on? You have these digital strategies.
So in fact, when we started our work in digital studios, I actually thought that it was going to be more of a millennial strategy. I thought that, we were observing that more people were cord cutters or cord nevers, and that we're spending more time on, you know, on digital platforms. And in fact, when we started putting some of our content on places like Hulu and Netflix and Xbox and others, it was a way of connecting content that we knew would be of interest to a younger audience, but perhaps they weren't thinking of PBS as the place where they were going to spend time. And so, you know, like specifically, we looked at Hulu as a place because we knew that it had a very large younger male audience for a lot of science content, for example, which tends to attract a male audience. And so I think that, you know, again, through the work that we've done on YouTube, we actually have found that we're aging down into, you know, sort of tweens and teens and, you know, sort of young 20s. So it's a slightly different audience than I thought we would attract, who's interested in smart, fast-paced content. Content we can share out because of the what we know about that audience. We know it's also being used by teachers in schools because of, again, the structure of it, where you're dealing with shorter form content. It just lends itself very well to that.
Individual giving versus large donors contributing to nonprofit media organizations. Recently, NPR was in the news over a controversy regarding the Plowshares Fund, which, as it turns out, had donated to NPR, and simultaneously they were involved in the Iran nuclear deal and kind of caused a kerfuffle. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you address people's concerns about large donors, large corporations coming in with large donations, and how people might perceive that as influencing PBS's news coverage.
So the strength of I'll comment on our own philanthropy. I know a bit about public radio as well, but you would probably be better suited to comment on that. I think on the television side, the base of our support has always been lots of small contributions, and you know, the amount of philanthropy coming into public television that's more in the major gift side has been relatively modest but growing. And I think that the amount of corporate philanthropy has also been not as large as people anticipate. I think that people always comment to me about the fact that, you know, you have all these, donors that are coming in, and wouldn't it be more efficient if you had, you know, some big philanthropy that would, you know, fund public media? And I think the reality is that the fact that we are so reliant on community-based fundraising, so this is the argument for the fundraising drives, by the way, is that it keeps us anchored in community and it keeps us accountable. And I think that people are smart and they can discern where there is influence or perceived influence. And I think that that really forces us to really pay attention. And when we do have moments where we may accept a gift that people may question, I think it's really up to us to, you know, constantly scrutinize, because I believe absolutely there's firm firewalls between philanthropy and editorial. I know it. I live it every day. We have an ombudsman that is very active, that that looks at these issues constantly, both at the station level as well as at PBS. But occasionally you may miss something, and you may accept a gift that there perhaps is the perception. And I think we just need to be very scrupulous about paying attention to that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. We're all done.